When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision?
Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all.
Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI.
Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow.
Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at ibm.com/consulting. IBM. Let's create.
During the summer when the weather gets hot, I can only imagine how much time you plan to spend outside with friends or alone on your couch with that AC blasting. AT&T 5G and home internet keeps you connected so you can enjoy all the summertime vibes, whether you're sharing pics from a rooftop, video calling your friends from an outdoor concert, or streaming your favorite show episode after episode. So stay connected to your favorite people and your favorite things with AT&T 5G and home internet. AT&T 5G requires compatible plan and device. Coverage not available everywhere. Learn more at att.com/5G for you.
Dealing with pests can be a pain, but relax. Terminix can help.
Because when pests show up, so does Terminix.
With over 95 years of experience, they have what it takes to take on any pest problem fast.
If your home or business has pests, don't stress it.
Terminix it.
Visit Terminix.com to book your appointment online today.
That's TERMINIX.com.
From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We are joined, as always, with our super producer, Alexis, codename Doc Holliday Jackson. Most importantly, you are you, you are here, and that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. It's the top of the week, which means it's time for some strange news. We've got a lot going on today. We sometimes will hop on our group thread and say, you know, like kick ideas back and forth. And one beautiful thing that happened behind the curtain today is leading up to today's episode, we were kicking around ideas that we were all kind of on the same page about. Where do you guys want to go first? Do you want to go to China? Do you want to go to Myanmar, formerly Burma? Do you want to go to Russia? We're going to all of these places, by the way, folks. So I hope at least one of those sounded exciting to you in the audience.
I feel like Myanmar might be the top story.
Sure, absolutely. Now, I bring this story to the table today, knowing some things, but not many things. And I will be leaning on you folk, to you gents, just to help me get through some of this. Just putting that out there as a disclaimer. Before we jump in, I am using a timeline, a chronology of events in the history of Myanmar and Burma. It is on bbc.com. The title, if you're looking for it, is Myanmar Profile-Timeline. It's just got everything going back all the way to 1057 CE.
BBC is great for those, by the way. They have one for pretty much every country.
Exactly. If you ever just want to get a basic idea of important things that have happened, check it out.
Turns out Brits are very organized and good at chronology.
Well, they're a little biased. If you're looking for a little bit of vicarious travel and you want to learn more, I think we've recommended this on the air before, check out Wikitravel articles. take them with a wheelbarrow of salt, but do check them out. They're a lot of fun.
Absolutely. And for the purposes of this story, there's a second timeline for more recent events that is very helpful to look at if you wanted to follow along or think about what's occurring here. Just get some more info for yourself. It's on Al Jazeera. It's called Myanmar Timeline of a Fragile Democracy. I believe it starts in 1947. Yeah. So that'll be helpful. Just keep those things in mind. All right. I'm actually going to a very different news source, something very much US-based, CBS News, for the article that kind of brought me into the conversation and down the rabbit hole. It is titled European Leaders Condemn Coup as Myanmar's Military Seizes Power, Detains Aung San Suu Kyi. Now, this kind of just popped up in my news feed and started learning about it. Let's talk about what's happening. Ben, I would just say again at the top here, this feels like an episode, like very much worth our time. Mm-hmm. So we may not hit everything right now, but we'll give you the lay of the land. Something very interesting happened in Myanmar, again, formerly Burma, as Ben mentioned there. I got rid of my map. But you can check out Myanmar, the country. It is in Asia. It is to the east of India and to the west of Thailand. You can think about it being over there. It's got a very interesting history over the years. The most important thing for you to know in this context is that for a number of years, up until 2011, I believe, Ben, correct me if I'm wrong here, it was controlled by essentially a military junta. The military was largely in control of what happened in the country and functioned as a government. And then some things changed in 2011 where the military kind of took a step back and some elections were held. And then the trajectory of the country felt like it was moving towards democracy, if not fully taking up democracy as its new way forward. And then after a large series of events in 2015, in November of that year, this party called the Opposition National League for Democracy, which is led by Aung San Suu Kyi, which is the person that was detained very recently. So what a lot of the hubbub is about. She was actually able, well, she and her party were able to get enough parliamentary seats in order to form a government, which is a big deal. It's very, Ben, we can talk about this maybe just for a moment. Democracies in a lot of countries function very differently than here in the United States, right, with our two-party system, where essentially whoever wins the presidency kind of controls that house over here. And then whoever, you know, within the House and Congress, each seat is individually elected rather than, you know, one person or one majority wins a certain number of votes and then they get to form their own group in parliament.
Right. Yeah. We're looking in many democracies outside of the United States, what we're looking at is the formation of coalitions. So say you have a party, say you have like a Green Party, and then you have, I don't know, Mad Lib the words however you want, the Conservative Socialist Party or the Democratic Libertarian Party or whatever, and they can't all quite get a majority rule, so they Voltron up together and do their best to create a coherent platform based on the goals that each of those groups prioritizes. So it can get messy and make for strange bedfellows at times, but it does tend to be better for the average citizen in those countries because they are more likely to have at least some of their values represented in government versus, you know, look how ridiculously difficult it is by design to start a viable third party in the U.S. with any chance of winning significant positions in office.
Such a good point, Ben. So we're talking about this occurring in 2015. Things are infinitely complicated up until this year, 2021, in this month, February. In November, I believe, of last year, there were elections. I want to say that's true. Yeah, I believe there were elections in November, and there appeared to be a landslide victory for that same party. Aung San Suu Kyi was leading, and the army itself took kind of mirrors what was happening in the United States here with our elections. The army just said this is not right. There has been voter manipulation. There has been someone has messed with these numbers. This election is a fraud. And the army itself, there's a chief, Min Aung Hlaing. He took power. Essentially, the military took power in the country in a full-on coup, and that is what's happening right now. They ended up detaining many members of that party that won the election and others who essentially oppose the military rule. I'm going to jump back to that CBS article to actually read some of this to you. It's weird the way it happened. On television there in Myanmar, there is a military-run network, and on this network, one of the anchors, I assume, or someone who is regularly appearing, came on and just announced that the military has taken control of the country and it will be in control for 1 year. And it's just kind of all happened at once. People were detained and then the announcement came through, and all of a sudden life in Myanmar as just a regular citizen is changed. Mm-hmm. Everything got flipped, turned upside down, as they say.
Worth it.
Sorry.
Worth
it. And of course, on the Western side in the United States and in many parts of Europe, everyone is coming out of the woodwork and saying, this is terrible, this is awful. I mean, obviously it is, right? Anytime a democratic election is overthrown by the might, essentially, of a military power within that government, it's probably not a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
In the long run, at least. It's kind of a hard thing to put a value judgment on, but generally when a strong arm comes through and just forces action, it's less good than if the people decide something.
Yeah, so just to clarify, essentially a military junta it's like a coup from within. I mean, it's like a strong man military official usurping the power of elected officials or of whomever is supposedly in charge, and then wielding his influence over the military and using that to, you know, cause a sea change in government.
Mm-hmm. And it's pretty controversial because a military intervention of this sort has often been portrayed as a good thing in other mm-hmm. cases across the world and over time, like interfering to prevent the rise of extremism or fascism. These sure. things can be considered part of a military's constitutional duty, you know, enemies abroad, domestic and abroad. But in this case, there is a big, big red badger just over the horizon that has a lot of influence in Myanmar. And Matt, I think we'll get to that in a second.
Well, right? Yeah. Well, I mean, it's exactly what you're talking about. The constitution of Myanmar was formed jointly with the military. And there is at least according to the television station that is owned by the military, when they announced this, they said that there's a section of the constitution that allows the military to take over in a time of national emergency.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially, an emergency was declared for the length of 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
And the moment it was declared, the military is now in power, at least according to the people who are causing this coup. And they will stay in power for 1 year. And they specifically said the takeover was in part due to, this is what I'm getting from CBS News, the government's failure to act on the military's claims. Now, that's important. The military's claims of voter fraud in the November election.
Right.
And its failure to postpone the election because of the coronavirus crisis.
Well, they demanded a recount, which was not granted because, from what I understand, the country's election commission did not see evidence of fraud. But if you look at the military's perspectives from their public statements, they say they're doing this as a legal, proactive, and preventative move to maintain stability, which is an odd thing to say with a straight face, given that these events forced all the banks to close, shops are running out of food, communication infrastructure is kaput. Those three things alone are, surprise, not the hallmarks of a stable government.
Yeah, it's a serious issue, and it's panic that comes from this kind of action, right? And uncertainty about what's to come. So, you know, everyday people like you listening and me and everybody on this Zoom call, if something like this starts going down, one of the first things you try and do is prepare yourself and your family with whatever essentials you need, with maybe cash. If you can, like, get as much cash out as you can, just in case you have to make moves. And the banks stop working all of a sudden at some point. That kind of panic is happening right now and will probably continue for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
I can only imagine the fear that's generated in a moment like this.
One important point to make here is that, this can be considered a coup, but how much of a change is it? Because the military dictatorship went out of power, ostensibly in 2010, but not really. Not really if you look at it, because it was able to force a compromise with the new government where it was granted 25% of the seats in parliament. And so if you asked the average person familiar with the situation, the real secret, not a secret here, is that the military and the junta could close its hands around the neck of the government anytime it wanted to. They just didn't for a while until, you know, this week.
Jeez.
Oh, they also had a veto over any constitutional changes.
Wow. I didn't even realize that. There's so much to be learned here. And I'm just going to say one more time, this is worth us looking at for a full episode, really giving you a good background on Myanmar and what's been happening there, and then all the details, because we're going to be learning a lot more over the course of this week of what's going down. A couple more things we can tell you here before we wrap this section. That same military TV network stated that the generals in charge of the country now, because remember, immediately they become in charge of the country, had removed a total of 24 government ministers and deputy ministers and replaced them with 11 handpicked replacements. So they just picked out their own people and put them in power there. They also mentioned that the new commander in chief would be a person, or this person that took over that I already mentioned, General Min Aung Hlaing, Hlaing, would be in charge, but there's a sitting vice president, Mint Swe, Mintswe, would be elevated to acting president. And this person is also a general who is apparently, at least according to CBS News, and I don't know the full story here yet, but is best known for a crackdown on Buddhist monks. And that occurred in 2007. And this person was and is a close ally of former junta leader Thanh Swe, S-H-W-E.
Oh, can I put in 2 points?
Please.
First, Suu Kyi has also come under fire for persecution of the Rohingya Muslims.
Yes.
You may have heard that headline in the news in past years. And one crazy thing that I hope that we'll explore for sure in the full episode is, I am wondering, not without basis, you guys, I am wondering whether this newest coup was in part motivated by astrology. What are we talking about? Don't ruin it for yourself. Don't search yet. We'll make it worth your while.
Astrology.
All of this makes me think of, you know, the idea of, oh, this would never happen in the United States. But Ben, you mentioned the kind of potential positive version of this, where a military coup could overtake, you know, a power grab by an overreaching president or whatever government, right? And it seems like, you know, we got to a place pretty recently that borderline approached that. But it also makes me think of the plot of the fantastic Stanley Kubrick movie, Dr. Strangelove, wherein a lone rogue high level military general essentially hijacks the entire military and orders an attack on the USSR that will ultimately result in mutual destruction. And there are certain safeguards in place that he uses that prevent any intervention in this. If anyone hasn't seen that, I think that's a really great, satirical example of what can happen when one person has too much power.
Yeah, no, for sure. I want to just remind everybody, imagine the scenario. Imagine you are wherever you are. Maybe in Kansas somewhere, maybe in the middle of Los Angeles, wherever you are listening to this. Imagine that all of a sudden you go to turn on the television and none of the stations are coming in for some reason. You can't get access to, you know, Verizon or whatever it is, you know, AT&T. Nothing's just, no signal is coming through. So you try to log in, but for some reason your Wi-Fi can't connect out to the internet. And you don't understand what's going on. You try and make a phone call to a relative or a friend that lives nearby, but the phone isn't making connections to anybody else. Just imagine that begins occurring. And imagine living through that and how, I know I would be in a state of serious panic if that were occurring.
Totally.
And I would be hunkered down immediately. That happened to many, many, many people. When this went down,
dude, people freaked out the season finale of The Sopranos when their TV went black for a split second. They're like, what happened? Like, the world collectively kind of lost their minds thinking that like the cable had all gone out at the same time or something. I mean, absolutely, dude. If I felt like all of a sudden communication was cut off from more than one source, I would absolutely be panicking.
Pro tip, if you can, you have the ability to do so, highly recommend keeping a landline phone. They're antiquated. They're not super useful the way that mobile phones are, but they have one important advantage that a lot of people are not aware of. If you have a corded phone, a landline phone, it'll work during a power outage. It's because the same thing that allows voice to carry also powers the phone. So keep one. If you're feeling especially paranoid or you think that your ability to communicate might be compromised, is a coup ever a good thing? It's a good question, at least. Typically, the way these are supposed to occur, if it's in a good case, is that the military intervenes for a limited window of time. And during that window of time, they facilitate free and fair elections, and then they transfer back to a civilian government. They're just supposed to come in and cameo. They're not supposed to rule for, you know, 54 years or something. So that's part of why there's that limited time frame of 1 year. But will that result in a free and fair election? I don't know, because the civilians and the military don't seem to agree on what constitutes a real election.
Exactly. All right, so we will keep looking out for updates on this and hopefully come back with more info very soon. For now, we're going to take a quick break, hear some sponsors, and then we'll be right back.
The following is a High Five moment from HighFiveCasino.com.
I won! Yahoo! Private, put down your phone. This is the army.
Sarge, High Five Casino is a social casino. It's on your phone. Goes wherever you go. I win free spins, cash, prizes, free daily rewards, over 1,200 games. I won again.
Platoon, present cell phone. High Five.
High Five.
Casino.
Casino.
Win at HighFiveCasino.com.
High Five Casino is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Conditions apply. See website for details.
High Five Casino.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire. With the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Finding the right news podcast can feel like dating. It seems promising until you start listening.
When you hit play on Post Reports, you'll get fascinating conversations and sometimes a little fun too. I'm Martine Powers.
And I'm Elahe Azadi. Martine and I are the hosts of Post Reports. The show comes out every weekday from The Washington Post.
You can follow and listen to Post Reports wherever you get your podcasts. It'll be a match, I promise.
If your business needs a new application, then developers will have to write code, a lot of code. If an application needs to be modernized, then you'll need time, resources, and caffeine. If that sounds daunting, then you need Watson X Code Assistant, AI designed to multiply developer productivity so you can generate code quickly. Let's create a more modern foundation for business with Watson X Code Assistant. Learn more at ibm.com/codeassistant. IBM. Let's create.
And we've returned. I want to thank everybody who's reached out to me on Instagram or on Twitter, or has reached out to us on the Facebook group page. Here's where it gets crazy. There is an awesome story that just came out, solving a very old mystery. This is going to be familiar to any of our longtime listeners and fellow conspiracy realists. Folks, Dyatlov Pass. This is a tale that is core conspiracy lore. You know, I love the classic stuff they don't want you to know vibe about this. It's a hell of a story. I'll give you a breakdown of the story itself, quick and dirty, and then we can explore the problems with that story, and we can explore the news. So,
Ben, before you get into this, you're saying Dyatlov Pass is solved?
Maybe.
Oh, okay. Okay. Good. There's still maybe some mystery. All right, let's keep going.
So the Dyatlov Pass incident refers to a series of events that occurred in February 1959, exactly 62 years to the day as we record today's strange news. So back in February 1959 in the northern Ural Mountains, nine Russian hikers died somehow during the night while they were camping in a site they had cut from the snow slope of the mountains. Something happened. No one was sure what, but whatever happened was fatal. And there were puzzling things at the crime scene. First, several folks were inadequately dressed. It seemed they had thrown off their clothes. One hiker's tongue was missing. Also, there was a lot of physical trauma. And then later, rumors would muddy the story. But we know that the Soviet authorities who investigated this determined that six had died from hypothermia, three had been killed by physical trauma, and there's a phrase they used, which was an unknown overwhelming force, depending on how you translate it. This was seen immediately as a cover-up. And very soon, because remember, the story circulated before the rise of civilian internet. So very soon, new stuff got added to the mix. You'll hear allegations that there were high radiation levels. You'll hear allegations that people were even glowing, or that there was unidentified aerial phenomena in the sky in the days leading up to this incident. The problem with this, for skeptics and true believers and conspiracy realists alike, is that one, this occurred under the purview of a notoriously secretive government. Two, a lot of time passed before this story really got its due diligence research-wise outside of the USSR. And then the next part is and the skeptics hated this, is that there wasn't really solid proof that a mundane event could explain this. So you could say it was just hypothermia all you want. But then someone who believes something different could say, well, hypothermia doesn't tear people's tongues out, or hypothermia doesn't crack your skull or give you incredible chest trauma. These are just the facts.
And it was not consistent injury to all of them. It wasn't like the same thing. I mean, there were variations, right? And it seemed like some intervening force was at play, right?
Mm-hmm. Amidst the various individual victims. So the mystery stands, and it does so much for shows like Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. Matt and I were in the trenches on Dyatlov for a long time. And interestingly enough, it's one of those stories, since it never had an explanation that was solid, it's one of those stories that we still get emails about. People still reach out to me on social about this and have for a number of years. We just pointed them to our video on this. And I think several years ago, we also did an audio podcast on these events. So one thing I noticed is that the frequency of people asking about this began to increase over 2020. You'll see trends like this come and go depending on any number of factors. But for everyone who wrote in about this, especially if you wrote in 2019, 2020, congratulations, you're plugged in. You're oddly prescient, my friends, because a new study released claims to have solved this enduring mystery. Very recently, a study published in Communications, Earth, and Environment walked through several computer models to, in their opinion, maybe not conclusively prove, but strongly suggest that we know the murderer of those 9 hikers. In a weird way, it might have been a self-inflicted disaster, a kind of avalanche, not the kind you're picturing, folks, not the kind from films about avalanches, not the kind of thing triggered by Saruman in Lord of the Rings when the thing that drives him back to the mines of Moria. Instead, this is something called a slab avalanche. Not to sound dismissive or glib, but I feel like they missed an opportunity to call it a slabalanche, which is just, it was right there. Here's what happened. The reason that we say this doesn't really compare to the avalanches of film and fiction is because typically those avalanches appear to happen as an instant A to B if then reaction. But the truth is, these actual avalanches, the ones that they're describing in the study, which we'll get into in a second, they have kind of a timer on them. An avalanche can happen minutes after the event that creates it, or it can happen hours and hours later. And this snowslide, this slabalanche, according to the authors of this study, could account for a lot of the missing pieces of information that bedeviled skeptics and conspiracy realists alike for decades, for, again, 62 years. Comes to us from Johan Guam, who is the head of the Snow Avalanche Simulation Laboratory, and Alexander Puzrin, who is the chair of geotechnical engineering at ETH Zurich. They dug deep. Guys, they pored over as much declassified Soviet research on this as they could, and then they took the latest avalanche research and simulations and tried to plug in this data, trying to essentially recreate the crime scene on a computer. Now, I want to pause here. When we have talked about Dyatlov in the past, what did you guys think? I didn't think it was just an avalanche.
I thought it was some kind of like murderer situation or some kind of ritualistic something. When you hear about smashed skulls and missing tongues, my brain immediately goes to psychopath on the loose.
It was always cryptid for me, Yeti, mm-hmm. or some type of large creature mm-hmm. that was causing mayhem.
I was into the idea of a secret technology myself. You know, I thought, I thought that would work with the Cold War era experimentation that was so frequent back in the day.
By the way, that doesn't mean that's what we actually think happened. That's just kind of our, well, what, how would you call it? Our pet theory, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So here are some of the missing pieces that the authors of the study were bothered by. First, this is your grisly fact for today, folks. First, most people in avalanches, if they die, they don't die due to broken bones or brain trauma or anything like that. They die by asphyxiation. They're buried alive. It's a very unclean way to go. And this is where challengers to the avalanche theory really butter their bread, because if you look at the slope and the incline of where the hikers chose to camp, it doesn't look like a hill. It doesn't look like very avalanche-friendly territory. You know what I mean? It's a slope, but it's not like a harsh mountain face with a steep incline. It's quite likely that the hikers, who knew what they were doing, purposely selected this site because it looked like it's not avalanche territory. But when they started camping, according to the authors here, what they did is they cut into the snow, into the slope, the same way that you might see like a ranch style home built into a hill in the suburbs, mm-hmm. Split level.
Or a hobbit hole built into the side of a hill.
Sure. And the thing that happened was that they triggered an avalanche, and the avalanche took several hours to get to them. Several hours to reach kind of a critical mass and ensue.
You don't think they would have noticed that, or it would have awakened them, the vibrations even off farther in the distance?
No. Well, maybe, but not giving them enough time to run away, because they would have, when it happened very quickly. And the tensions leading up to it, according to this idea, would not have been super easy to discern if you're just a human hiking with the technology they had. So a slab avalanche occurs when there's a dense slab of snow that's sitting over a snow layer that's weaker. So it's already kind of heavy and haphazard. And when there's some sort of trigger that compromises that weaker snow, or pushes harder on that strong slab, then it eventually tips over, it falls, it creates a snow slide. And this can occur on slopes with an angle of fewer than 30 degrees. So something that doesn't look like avalanche territory again. And the other thing is, another question, avalanches are big, right? Why didn't somebody else notice this? And Soviet authorities are well acquainted with avalanches. Russia is a snow-filled country. This avalanche could have been comparatively small. And if it were small enough, rescuers wouldn't see signs of an avalanche later. But even the smallest of these slab avalanches can weigh hundreds and hundreds of pounds, meaning that if you were, depending on where you're standing when it hit, you could have your bones broken, you could have your skull cracked, you could have your ribs crushed. So this is where they're at. And they did various simulations, not just of how this would occur, but of how people would be injured, like in this scenario.
Well, and the other thing, Ben, is we know that some of the group did die there. They perished in the tent or right near the tent. But then there are others who died further away. Is there anything discussing what may have happened to them?
Great question, Matt. And it's something that I'm glad to say the authors are aware of, because they don't claim with certitude that this is the silver bullet solution. Instead, they say in a documentary about this paper that was just released, they say, personally, we do not believe that the mystery can ever be solved because no one survived to tell the story. What we did in our paper is to show the plausibility of the avalanche hypothesis based on solid physical and experimental evidence. In a way, Matt, I guess you could call this a kind of non-living cryptid, because it's such an unusual kind of avalanche. You know what I mean? It took our species 62 years to think about this.
And just really quickly, like, I mean, when you're talking about the way it moves, you know, you think of an avalanche as being like powdery snow and people would typically die from asphyxiation. This is literally huge, rigid pieces that coming down this, the side of the mountain where they're camped could have hit them on the edge coming down, like almost like a giant slab of marble, and then knocked, you know, their skulls open, or literally, you know, could have caught someone by the jaw and ripped their tongue out. Is that the conjecture here?
Yeah, quite possibly. I mean, at that point, we're still talking about various likelihoods with no solid proof, right? So we have to remember, it also took the original rescuers several months to recover the bodies of all nine hikers. They were definitely on a manhunt. I would like to shout out Vice and Smithsonian Mag for some excellent reporting on this. As well as the St. Petersburg Times. Here's the thing about missing organs, and this is kind of gross and explicit, but I think a lot of folks who've spent time in the wild are familiar with this. Scavengers go for the soft stuff first. Those are the delicacies, the eyeballs, the tongue, the, you know, your unmentionables. Those things are easy for creatures to access. And they're a lot less work than, say, trying to gnaw at bone marrow, things like that, right? You have to be a scavenger specifically adapted to that sort of diet. So it's completely plausible that one of the victims, such as Ludmila Dubinina, was missing both her eyeballs and her tongue because something happened along after the avalanche occurred and after she expired. And then it ate the eyes and the tongue and continued upon its way.
Yeah. Jeez. Mm-hmm. So Ben, just pause at this. What I'm imagining is this avalanche occurs at the side of the tent where they dug out from the side, right? Causing that avalanche to the slab to slide on top of one of the other layers. The heavy stuff kills some people almost immediately, or at least gravely injures them. Then maybe people who've survived that initial sliding slab gather each other up who are able to walk and try to get the heck out of there, and then maybe freeze. And
yeah,
that's exactly. That's how they expire. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. The idea is that they were sleeping. The slab struck. Those who could ran searching for shelter at a ridge nearby. To get a sense of the weather conditions, they couldn't see much further than maybe 50 feet in front of themselves. And so they froze to death as they were trying to find shelter. And then as they were trying to make their way back to the tent, perhaps. And again, the Soviet government's lack of transparency, the official findings, lack of scientific details made for a perfect storm of conspiracy. And, you know, in 2019, oddly enough, the current Russian government had announced plans to reinvestigate this incident. So a reframing of this was in the cards for a while. They opened a new investigation. And part of it, I think, is just to recognize the importance. I mean, closure for the families and relatives of those who passed away, and hopefully taking lessons learned so that we understand situations like these when they occur in the future again, which is, again, just it's a statistical certainty that something like this would occur again. But it has critics. That's the other thing. The Slabalanche has some folks poking holes in it already. Here are some of the objections. One, the lack of physical traces of an avalanche found by rescuers. We mentioned that. It would have to be a pretty small avalanche, comparatively speaking, to not leave behind a ton of evidence. Secondly, and I think this is a little more valid, the gap. We mentioned these can occur minutes after the snow is compromised or hours. But when we're looking at this slab avalanche as an explanation here, we have to remember there was a 9-hour gap between the hikers building their camp, cutting into the mountain to form a barrier against the wind, and then the snow hitting the fan. Managed to keep it a family show.
Jeez, dude.
And then they also talk about the shallow slope of the campsite and, of course, the traumatic injuries. So it's not conclusive yet, but the investigators are, one of the investigators, at least Puzrin, is certain that if the group had not cut into the slope, nothing would have happened. But when they cut into the slope, they created a crack and it propagated and expanded over time. If you have ever been unfortunate enough to crack your smartphone, you are well aware of how this process works. That crack will slowly expand and branch off. If you have...
Windshield.
Windshield was my next example. Yeah, exactly. Boy, a windshield crack is one of the most like existentially depressing problems to have because you see it every day, wherever you're driving. Just ticking a little bit closer. You know, it makes you think about mortality, the seventh seal, all the hits.
How much you need that extra $150 to get it replaced, but you just can't seem to find it.
God, I feel like you and I were going through that the same period, man, in the discovery days. There is a fun light note here that I thought was enjoyable, and we can end on this. The researchers credit a surprising source for helping them unravel this puzzle. You're probably not going to be able to guess what it is. So we'll just tell you, folks, it is Frozen. That's right. The Disney film from 2013, Frozen, Let It Go, the whole nine. According to some reporting from National Geographic, one of the authors of the study was watching Frozen. And remember, this is an avalanche expert. He's watching Frozen and he was thinking, wow, I am so impressed by how good they are at depicting snow. In fact, I am so impressed because I am an avalanche specialist. I'm going to reach out to the people who made Frozen and I'm going to ask them for the code they use to animate snow because it's amazing. They should be working for me. Why are you in Hollywood? It's about more than the money, you guys. I'm editorializing, maybe a bit, but he reached out. And they gave him the code, and then they used that along with grisly research on cadavers conducted by GM, General Motors, back in the 1970s. There's a pretty creepy car stuff episode about this, too. It's a true story. Once upon a time, General Motors used real dead bodies instead of crash test dummies. Did you know that? Did we ever talk about that?
Yeah, we did talk about that. Maybe not on the air, but yeah.
That was just one of those moments where in the office, one of us looked over at the other one from the computer and then like cursed softly under their breath. And then we lost 2 hours from whatever we were supposed to be doing.
When we had that conversation, it was the first time I ever imagined a haunting of a vehicle. And, I don't know if you remember this. The concept of ghost ships has always been around, but I'd never thought about a ship like on the sea its interior being haunted until that terrible, terrible horror movie came out called Ghost Ship or whatever it was called.
I remember that. Yeah.
But that one happened. But then we had this conversation about crash test dummies being cadavers. And I imagined just like a Camry getting haunted over the years with an actual apparition like attached to the physical place.
I think people would pay extra for it.
I don't know.
Advertised as a feature.
That feels like a real hazard if you're on the highway.
Yeah, I guess it depends on the ghost, you know? Yeah. But if it's like helpful ghost mode, why use a defroster when you can have somebody...
Pretty sure that breath would be icy, dude.
Oh, that's true. That's true. We need to workshop this. Mm-hmm. First, prove ghosts exist. Yep. Secondly, figure out how to commodify them and put them in an automobile coming to a dealer near you. On it. Thank you, Love Pass. For anybody who feels that this is kind of a downer, or feels that this is itself the continuation of a cover-up, there's one last thing I want to leave you with that may be of interest. Remember earlier I mentioned that 2019 reopened investigation on part of the Russian government. They were not investigating all the proposed causes. They went for the three most likely ones. And so this means that they squarely in advance decided to ignore the idea of anything like an individual human or cryptid murderer, unexplainable, unidentified flying objects, or of course, secret Soviet tech. So if you are feeling very X-Files, you still want to believe there may be something else still buried beneath the avalanche of reporting on this story. We're going to pause for a word from our sponsor, and we'll be back with more strange news.
The following is a High Five moment from HighFiveCasino.com.
I won! Yahoo! Private, put down your phone. This is the army.
Sarge, High Five Casino is a social casino. It's on your phone. Goes wherever you go. I win free spins, cash, prizes, free daily rewards, over 1,200 games. I won again.
Platoon, present cell phone. High Five.
High Five.
Casino.
Casino.
Win at HighFiveCasino.com.
High Five Casino is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Conditions apply. See website for details.
High Five Casino.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
Before AI can help your business predict demand, accelerate growth, inform decisions, automate tasks, reveal insights, generate content, you have to trust it. Introducing WatsonX Governance, helping you govern any AI as data, models, and policies change so you can scale it responsibly. Let's create AI that begins with trust with WatsonX Governance. Learn more at ibm.com/governance. IBM, let's create.
And we're back with more strange news. I guess this is it. This is our third segment. I guess I have the honor and the privilege of going last today. And it is kind of a momentous day in the history of technology. Maybe not day, it's week perhaps. But you guys are children of the internet like myself. We all grew up with dial-up modems and remember the first day that a cable modem was a thing and Spotify and all that. You know, and even before that, GeoCities and animated GIFs and all of the little things, the little beautiful treasures that the internet has bestowed upon us over the years. And one of the things that we can all absolutely thank for many of those treasures is the Adobe company and Adobe Flash. You guys remember Flash?
Oh yeah. When the first band I was in had a website that was this amazing Flash animation a friend of ours made of just the name of our band, but like forming in Flash.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was beautiful. And It's the first program I ever used to edit a video. The first video I ever made was a terrible Flash thing where I wasn't animating. I was just shooting video and then putting it into Flash and trying to put together a thing.
Some of my favorite nerd games are in Flash.
Totally.
Were. Mm-hmm. It's a thing of the past. I tried to figure it out, but I went ahead and just played them all one last time.
That's right. You got it, Ben. You nailed it, because Flash is dead. As of January 12th of this year, Flash has bit the dust. It is absolutely no longer supported by Adobe, in that it won't be patched anymore. There will be no more updates. And depending on who you ask, and I'm not a super duper, in the weeds computer expert in this way. I have enough of a working understanding to understand the basics of things like coding and line commands, command lines, and all that. But apparently there is some kind of built-in thing in the latest version of Flash that deactivates it in some way. We'll get into what that could mean or does mean. But I just wanted to do just a little bit of a brief kind of history of Flash, because a lot of this stuff, it was kind of nostalgic and fun for me. Flash originally started in 1995 when two friends by the name of Jonathan Gay and Charlie Jackson met at a Macintosh users group and decided that they became pals based on their mutual appreciation of programming for Macs, because that wasn't as much of a thing at the time. We hadn't seen the Mac renaissance that we, that led to where we are now with things like the iPhone and Macs being the absolute gold standard for audio and computer editing and animation and all of that. So they were very much ahead of the curve, and they essentially kind of put their heads together through their skills of being able to kind of program basic graphic editors and games and such, and decided they wanted to make something that would use pen computers, essentially early forms of tablets that use like a stylus. So they started building something called Smart Sketch, which is a graphics editor for Mac for pen computers. And then it eventually evolved into something called Future Splash that was originally a component for Smart Sketch and then became kind of a thing unto itself. And it was an animator. And if you what you're talking about, Matt, with the really rudimentary kind of Flash editor, that's sort of what this early version looked like. It was essentially almost had the look of a Word document with like a big empty field at the bottom. And then at the top you had a very rudimentary version of what you might see today in After Effects or in any kind of editor, where you have multiple tracks or layers that you can drag things into. It incorporated things like tweening or in-betweening, where you can like set a beginning point and an end point for like a rudimentary kind of stick animation and or 2D animation, then it would fill in the gaps. So in 1986, where many of us probably came up Cross Flash originally, was the company called Macromedia bought Flash in 96, and then it became Macromedia Flash. It turned from Future Splash into Flash. And that's kind of the big heyday of Flash, was when it became basically, it was so popular because of early adoption from like Netscape, if you remember Netscape, or eventually it was called Mozilla, because it could do like animation headers for websites that didn't require like real-time video playback. And it was just like much more versatile than an animated GIF, which was all just stored in one file. And it was interactive. You could add little buttons, almost like a DVD menu, things called action scripts, and it became kind of the design platform du jour for the internet. And it's really what we think of as the look of the internet from the mid to late 90s. And even the early days of YouTube, entirely based around Flash. The earliest versions of YouTube were designed in Flash. In fact, Chad Hurley, Stephen Chen, and Jawad Karim were kind of toying with the idea of maybe doing a dating site or, something else. And they had a meeting with an investor named Keith Rabois, forgive me if I'm mispronouncing that, it's R-A-B-O-I-S, and he mentioned they were working on a streaming video site, and he asked if they were designing in Flash, and when they said yes, he agreed to invest because it was so ubiquitous. Then the tide for Flash kind of turned when the iPhone came out, and Steve Jobs basically unequivocally counted it out of any iPhone releases. He found it to be buggy. He found it to be unstable. He found it to have security flaws. So it was not part of the iPhone at all. And that really kind of spelled the beginning of the end for Flash. So RIP Flash, but my real story for today, I guess, is surely there are some, you know, websites or, God forbid, larger institutions that are still relying on Flash and didn't get the memo that it was going to, you know, go the way of the dodo. And that actually turns out to be the case for a small region in China. And this wasn't like, you know, news to anybody. You know, Adobe announced that they were sunsetting Flash back in 2017. They would be deactivating the plugin and its extensions by the end of 2020. So they actually gave a little bit of a grace, you know, a couple weeks into 2021. But earlier this month, when it happened, according to Apple Daily, officials at the China Railway Shenyang had been using Flash-based software to plan many aspects of their daily train routes and shipping. And as a result of the sunsetting of the software, it caused about 20 hours of absolute chaos. Apparently, they weren't able to dispatch trains, and it led to the railroad shutting down completely in Dayan, Liaoning province. And apparently, they were able to roll back the software to an earlier version of Flash Player that didn't have this deactivating code. But again, I've seen some chatter on the internet saying maybe that's not entirely the case. The idea of the self-deactivating code, that does seem a little kind of weird why they would do that. But it still feels like if it wasn't being supported or if there was like it needed an update. I'm not exactly sure. What do you guys think about this? Does this have the ring of truth or does this seem like maybe somebody missed something along the way?
When you're talking about Flash itself being like deactivating itself,
the idea of why would they do that? Why would they build a self-deactivating clock into a piece of software? I would think it would be more just them not supporting it anymore, not patching it, not updating it.
Well, it's a way to protect end users because it really is, Flash Player really is a massive vulnerability for attacks. And it has been for a long time. And if it's no longer updated and just supported and they left it dead on machines of millions and millions of people across the world, then anyone who wanted to could just find a machine that still had it installed and get in through various ways to a machine. So I think it's a smart move on Adobe's part to make sure it's self-destructing. Actually, you know what? I need to triple check and make sure I actually took it off of this machine. Now right. That I'm thinking about it.
Yeah, Flash had problems. The exploits that you mentioned, Matt, are common. You know what I mean? And they weren't necessarily high level hacker black hat stuff. You could have script kiddies just cut and paste their way into some pretty serious stuff using Flash. The thing is, part of the problem is not just that it was insecure, but that it was powering a large portion of the internet, or of, you know, a lot of ways people encountered the internet. And this was a heavy, heavy weighs the head that wears the crown situation for Adobe because they made it. So how many messages were they getting for years on a daily basis saying, what the hell is going on with Flash? I bet they had some snarky titles too, like Newsflash, your plugin sucks, or all kinds of other weird, mean messages. And the more popular it got, it's kind of like the reason that the Honda Civic is often listed as the most frequently stolen car in the United States. It's not necessarily because it's the most amazing car in the United States. It's because it's super common. Mm-hmm. And because Flash was super common, hackers were able to get more bang for their buck if they built exploits that worked with this. If fewer people used Flash, then hackers would not have paid near as much attention to it.
Just going to say the Civic is a lot easier to boost than, I don't know, a Maserati.
Well, you sell for the parts. Never sell the whole car if you want to make money.
You know, it's funny. There was a little addendum on this. This story originated on a website called Apple Daily. And then there were other websites that kind of reposted it and added some addendums. But one that I got recently, ARS Technica, it just posted an update. And it said a reader found a blog post questioning whether the flash problem affected train dispatching. It also says that the railroad reverted to an old version of Adobe Flash, but not a pirated version. That was actually the pirated version was in the original Apple Daily article. But then as a non-Chinese speaker, it's hard for me to be sure if the Apple Daily article is accurate. But then this is the interesting part. The latest Flash client in China can still be downloaded from flash.cn as per Adobe's end-of-life Flash support page. It has no time bomb and will keep receiving, so the time bomb is real, security patches for a while. But here's the most interesting part. There is a company called Harman, which is a subsidiary of Samsung, that Adobe offloaded all of its Flash-related activities to. And apparently that, you know, support still exists for legacy Flash-based software that should continue well past the cutoff date. So it sounds to me like the administrators of this system in China might have been more to blame than the software itself.
And if you are still running Flash at this point, please remember to uninstall whatever you're doing there. Because in Adobe's own words, they strongly recommend, like a month ago, they were strongly recommending all users immediately uninstall Flash.
Because like you were saying, Matt, it's been kind of notoriously an entry point for, you know, folks wanting to do harm to systems, right?
Yeah. That's why the update is always so important. The same thing with Apple OS. Just recently, strongly recommended everybody update. Same thing with the last Mac OS that went through. It's just like every time a new exploit gets identified, you got to update. And doesn't mean they go away. Doesn't mean all of them go away or there's never going to be another one. It just means the ones that are that we're aware of need to get fixed.
It's a beautiful dance of trying to outsmart one another, and the disadvantage for the non-hacker side of the equation is that it's often reactionary, right? That's why you have white hat hackers who find exploits and notify software creators. But remember, if you decide to keep Flash because you have a soft spot for one thing or another that's Flash related, remember it's not just a matter of whether you feel like you'll be okay now. You might be saying, I don't have a railroad to wreck. Well, good. And also, you know, I'm sorry. I know owning a railroad's a dream for a lot of people, but you have to remember that even if you keep something around, Adobe is never going to update this again. It's just going to get older and older and increasingly archaic, which means the liability window you have there is just going to enlarge over time.
Mm-hmm. Some folks that I like a YouTube channel of, it's called Internet Today, made a really interesting point that it's something that, you know, we've probably all been in a situation where we're wondering this. When you go to the airport and they're entering things one finger at a time on these terminal computers, you know, that are clearly running some super old proprietary OS, you know, or think about like the types of operating systems that run, say, you know, nuclear power plants. They want those to be as stable and uncomplicated as possible so that they're dependable constantly. Mm-hmm. And they don't constantly have to update them. And these systems are not usually on the wider web, you know, a lot of the time, right, or they're on some sort of intranet, you know, for the actual company. But it's not like they're connected or have to, you know, interface with all these other like HTML5 or whatever. So whenever you're at the airport and you're wondering why it seems like such an antiquated system, it's probably because it is, but it's also probably for your benefit.
Mm-hmm. And also, by the way, don't forget, there was a massive U.S. government hack. There have been like state level hacks working off Flash. To your point about separating things from the wider internet, we're talking about two terms there. There's firewalling and then there's air gapping. Air gapping means there is a physical obstacle keeping something from ever being connected to the web. That's why Stuxnet, if anybody recalls that, was so impressive. It had to be physically carried to the machines of the Iranian government. But you're right. You're right. People want reliable. They don't want, well, I guess we can't say flashy in this segment, but they don't want, you know, really showy, impressive bells and whistly stuff. They're completely okay with the black and green text terminal screen as long as they know it will always work. And shout out to the people, by the way, on the development and maintenance side who have to keep those dinosaurs breathing. I can't imagine. You know what I mean? Like every large company or many large companies have stuff like this, especially oddly enough, infrastructure related things, airlines, air traffic control. I mean, anybody who's been into the tech side of a lot of very powerful government agencies will tell you war stories about legacy software. I bet we have people who are listening today who have some stories of their own. I'd love to hear them. What's the oldest, weirdest thing you've seen?
Dude,
if
totally.
You can tell us.
Yeah, and shout out to Adobe in particular, because you're only hearing this because I'm rolling right now in their product called Audition. I think that might be the same for you guys too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, don't feel bad for them. They're going to be okay, folks.
And you can also thank Premiere for a lot of the videos that came out on Stuff They Don't Want You to Know that are still out there on Stuff They Don't Want You to Know on the YouTube channel.
And you can find that at youtube.com/conspiracy stuff. No longer coded in Flash like back in the day, but it much, much zippier. And you can see our heads in boxes for every piece of content that we put out. And let us know what you think.
Segway. Yes. Let us know. That sounds like let it snow. So let us know your opinion about the new proposed explanation for Dyatlov Pass. Do you feel vindicated? Do you feel disappointed? Do you feel there's more to the story? Also, incredibly important here, if you are a resident of Myanmar or you have spent time there, you have connections, let us know. We always like to hear primary sources on the ground. I do want to thank the people who have already reached out with some questions and some accounts. This is an area of the world that is unfamiliar to a lot of the West, and we hope that you explore it with us in a future episode. Also, if you own a railroad, what's that like? Let us know. Not counting Railroad Tycoon or whatever that simulator is, but I hear good things. We try to be easy to find on the internet, folks. Unlike Adobe Flash, you can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter. You can find us on Instagram. We love to recommend our Facebook community page. Here's where it gets crazy, where we have officially welcomed a brand new moderator. Say hello to Jennifer when you get a chance. But I'm not going to, you might be saying. You guys know I hate social media. It's not my thing. It doesn't wreck my trains. If that's the case, well, we've thought ahead on this, and you are in luck because we also have a phone number.
That's right. You can reach us at 1-833-STWITK. That's STDWITK. I feel like I stuttered that one a little bit the first time around. Leave us a message at the sound of Ben's dulcet tones. 3 minutes is the time limit that you will have. That is your 3 minutes. Do us a solid and try to stick to one of those 3 minute blocks. You'll be much more likely to hear yourself on one of our weekly listener mail episodes. And please let us know what to call you, or if this is absolutely off limits to use your voice on listener mail episode, in which case we may still be able to recount your tale without using your audio, but we prefer to be able to play the audio. I think that adds a nice dimension to it.
That's right. And if you don't want to do any of those things, the best way to reach us is kind of old fashioned, but we love it. We are
conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
The following is a high-five moment from highfivecasino.com.
Welcome to Burger Yippee. Would you like a hot apple? pie today?
Yes, yes, yeah, I won! Woohoo!
So that's a yes on the apple pie?
I just went big time playing High Five Casino on my phone. Real cash prizes, free daily rewards, over 1,200 games. Yeah.
So yes or no on the apple pie?
Woo! I won again!
I'll take that as a yes. Drive around.
Have you had your High Five moment today? Only at HighFiveCasino.com.
High Five Casino is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Conditions apply. See website for details.
High Five Casino.
Ever wolfed down a Big Mac and thought, I need some extra cash?
Mm-hmm.
Then download the Drop app. Get rewarded for dining out and more. Use code DROP22 for $5 in points. Download Drop now.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
We went from normal life, healthy child, to acute lymphoblastic leukemia, or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.